This is a Haunted Attraction Network production. Achieve more with all our products at www.hauntedattractionnetwork.com.
On today's segment of Haunting the Globe, we're revisiting the Vault of Souls in Tampa, Florida. This time last year, we spoke with creative director Scott Swenson and discussed the planned premiere of the Vault of Souls, an experience aiming to capture the elegance of fear. Following a very successful year one, Scott is back to discuss the event's evolution. Now, onto the show.
This is Haunting the Globe. Short but intense interviews from haunted attractions around the world.
Hi, I'm Scott Swenson. I'm the creative director for the Vault of Souls in Tampa, Florida. This is our second year of bringing elegant fear to life. It's kind of an unusual haunted experience because it's first off paranormal-based as opposed to blood, guts, and gore-based or based on any sort of equity or existing movie or game or anything like that. It's actually based on the history of the building itself, which is in downtown Tampa. It's on the corner of Franklin and Twig Street in Tampa. And it's the building itself is a bank building that opened in 1923. And we've incorporated the history not only of the building, but also of the downtown Tampa area throughout the 20s to sort of bring this mythology to life. And last year we introduced the mythology of this bank that has created a way to store people's souls sort of in a repository underneath the bank, just in case they're afraid that their afterlife might not be that pleasant. Because let's face it, the 1920s was kind of a rough time in Tampa. There was a lot of bootlegging going on. There was a lot of gangsters coming down from the north. Gambling had just come in from Cuba. According to the mythology, from 1923 until today, every year in the fall, when the veil between this world and the next is at its thinnest, people can participate in a very elegant and posh ritual that may actually guarantee them a spot in the Vault of Souls when their time comes to leave this plane of existence. It's designed to be an immersive, interactive, theatrical experience. We've rebranded and got a brand new website out there called elegantfear.com because that pretty much describes what the event is all about. When guests arrive, everything is time ticketed, so you must make a reservation prior to arrival. When you arrive, your car is valet parked, which is included with the price of admission. The first act takes place in the lobby of the bank building, which is a three-story tall white marble lobby. And it's a very posh cocktail party, which has live performances. There's a live cellist in there. And then this year we actually have some apparitions that appear and disappear through the walls. And we've also added a ballerina this year, as well as some other characters. When your name is called, you proceed into the second act, which we call the ritual. Now, the second act is a 12,000 square foot non-linear haunted experience where all of the guests are the ones who are wearing the masks. Everyone is asked to wear a neutral white face mask and not to speak so that the spirits don't recognize them and try to follow them out. They then proceed via elevator into a real basement, and there's no pathway, and guests are encouraged to explore on their own. They're allowed to touch anything except the spirits themselves, but the spirits may make physical contact with the guests to sort of guide them and lead them around. So there are dead ends. There are rooms that guests may not get into unless they're invited into them. And it's, you know, although it shares some of the same elements as an escape room, it is clearly not an escape room. The goal is not to go through a checklist of activities. The goal is to uncover as much of the story as is right for you. Last year, we discovered that guests spent anywhere from 20 minutes to 3.5 hours exploring this labyrinth of history underneath this historic bank building. Then when guests do decide to come back to the world of the living, they come up into a 1920s speakeasy, also called the gin joint. And there are flappers, there's a piano bar, handcrafted cocktails in there. And then on the third floor, we have tarot readers who will actually do an actual tarot reading for all guests who would like one. And plus, we've added some extra entertainment up there as well. There's a gelato and espresso bar on the third floor. So it's designed to be a full evening of elegant fear for grown-ups who still enjoy celebrating Halloween without going out and trick-or-treating or being chased into a gift shop with a chainsaw. That's really what the Vault of Souls is all about, and we are very proud to be back for our second year, and we are enthusiastic to see how our guests will respond to the new characters, the new plot lines, and diving a little bit deeper into the mythology and the story behind this interactive experience.
Heading off of that, can you dive a little bit with us here into those mythologies and a little bit of the changes that you've made from the previous year?
Sure. Some of the stories, the main character or the main character that you see in a lot of the marketing is a young lady. We're guessing she's somewhere between 12 and 13 years old. Her name is Lucy. And she was actually the, for lack of a better term, beta tester for this repository, for this vault. When she passed, her spirit, her soul, was the first to be contained because they felt it was safer to do a test containment with a young girl versus a hardened criminal. So in case something went wrong, there wouldn't be a malevolent spirit running loose in downtown Tampa. The agreement or the original understanding was that her parents would be able to join her when their times came as well. However, it became so incredibly profitable for the bank president that he never allowed her parents to join her when they passed. However, her father was a remarkably passionate man and cared very much for his daughter. And in last year's experience, you would see remnants of him and letters from him throughout the ritual experience underneath the bank. And you could always tell they were from him because they had an eye on them. Because he told James Griffin, who was the president of the bank at the time, that I will always keep an eye on my daughter. So anytime you saw an eye either painted on the wall or on a written document, that was Lucy's father watching out for her. This year, we've actually added a character of Lucy's mother, and she appears in spectral form. However, she doesn't stay in the realm of the ritual for very long. Again, it's her love and her commitment to her daughter that has allowed her to sort of puncture through the containment, but she can't stay there for very long. So she fades in and fades out and interacts in real time with the guests. And we're bringing back a very classic illusion that has been used both in theater and in haunt for years. A lot of people know it as Pepper's Ghost. But we're taking a Pepper's Ghost effect and kind of taking it to a new level because we're actually using a puppet as the Pepper's Ghost spirit. Actually, the tests so far have been very interesting, how she kind of floats and appears, but will still be able to interact in real time with the guests as they pass by.
Excellent. When I think of Vault of Souls and I think of you, Scott, I think of, you know, a thought leader in the attraction space for interactivity. And last year we discussed a lot of the components that you had worked into Vault of Souls. And you kind of touched on them a little bit in your description with the components of the guests being able to unlock rooms and being able to explore this interactive environment. Can you take us through some of the interactive components that you have planned for this year and what has changed?
The interactivity has just continued to grow. We found that our guests really liked being a part of the story last year. They, you know, as I explained to our cast members, the guests are not only audience, but also fellow characters within the story. They help drive it forward and unlock, you know, certain elements and sometimes quite literally unlock. One of the new rooms this year, for example, is a room that is filled with vintage lock boxes, vintage safety deposit boxes. And there will be keys hidden, located throughout the entire basement experience. And if guests find one of these keys and take them back to this room, they may actually be able to unlock yet another part of a story. Because each one of those lock boxes will have a tidbit, whether it's a prop from one of the characters' storylines or a letter or an article or something for them to pick up and read to help enrich that story one level further. Now, not everybody will want to take the time and effort to try to find some of these keys, and that's fine too, because the character who is there will also help illuminate parts of the story. But for those who are really interested in going deeper, in digging deeper into the world, they'll be able to do that by finding those keys.
Excellent. So the keys where guests can actually search, hunt them, find them, and then use them to unlock pieces of the story and thereby have influence on kind of melding the story, discovering more about it, kind of digging deeper into all the layers that you have planned there.
Exactly. You know, it's interesting because everybody will come out of there with different parts of the story. I try to make it as multifaceted and multi-layered as possible. So not everyone will get every single piece of the story. It's just like the real world. You know, we don't always understand every facet of every story. And I think that happens, you know, I think it happens everywhere. I think it happens in politics. I think it happens in crime investigations. You only get bits and pieces of the story and then make your decision based on that. The way I like to look at it is the guests from the Vault of Souls will leave the experience with the story that they are personally supposed to have. And it may be different from the person who they came with. And then they, when they go upstairs to the third floor or into the gin joint, they can sit there and have a cocktail and discuss, hey, did you see this or did you discover that? And maybe they can have not only their own individual versions of the story, but also a collective version of the story, which is kind of fun.
Yeah, excellent. So essentially, it's a little bit like what we talked about previously. I mean, it is an element of manufacturing individuality. I mean, there all of those elements are placed and kind of reset every time the crowd goes in, but there's kind of a very high number of possible combinations. So it's very unlikely that any one person will experience this in the same way, because that, you know, the likelihood that one person will come across the exact same pieces and put them all together and discuss them in the same way is very low.
That's exactly correct. And what we discovered in our first year is that guests take even more control over the story when they will take certain props and relocate them. It's very rare that they will actually take them out of the basement or take them out of the ritual area, but quite regularly there were bits and pieces that would show up in different rooms. So people wouldn't necessarily even find them in the same order, and even the same order as we anticipated them being found. There are things that ended up in the main vault, which is, you know, really this stellar piece of scenery. And I use the term scenery very loosely because it's the actual vault from the bank, something we could never have afforded to build. But, you know, there are things that end up in that vault that guests felt for some reason were needed to be protected somehow. So even the guests manipulate the storyline even beyond what we plan it to be.
That's excellent. It's a great way of allowing people to take ownership of the story for themselves.
Exactly. And, you know, many of our guests really enjoy that sense of mastery and control over their environment. You have to be an active participant in this experience. Now, that doesn't mean that you need to be violent or, you know, malicious, but you have to explore a little bit. Those people who are coming into the Vault of Souls expecting a passive experience that they just, you know, walk through and look at stuff, that is not what we're about. We are definitely looking for people who are there to interact with the characters. The characters will try to get them to interact with them and to go ahead and explore on their own just to see what they can find.
So I have kind of two follow-ups on that. One, the first thing is, as you mentioned, you are kind of seeking out specific types of people. You know, this is definitely an attraction that is designed for that type of person, right? That wants the control, that wants the interactivity, very much not the passive person, which is, I think, you know, in many ways, counter to how most attractions operate. I mean, most things out there, you know, especially theme park driven, like you live and die by throughput. I mean, a lot of it is, you know, classically where we were coming from several years ago is people are passive and they are watching a thing happen. And you're trying to make a pretty major shift over to the exact opposite type of person. So I guess, how do you go about training your audience to be active participants so they can fully enjoy the Vault of Souls?
You know, that's an excellent question. And it was something that we struggled with our first year. And I think we're still struggling with a little bit this year as well. It is unique. And I'm not going to sit here and say, well, this is what a haunt should or shouldn't be. But it is another way of looking. And training the audience is a challenge. We tried to make it so that even in things like our website and our Facebook pages and the Twitter account, et cetera, is that we start dropping hints so that people will start looking even before they get there. I mean, a perfect example is when guests or make their reservations at elegantfear.com, they will be emailed a letter from the bank secretary from the 1920s. And if you read the letter, it gives you a little bit of backstory. And then if you read only the bolded letters, it gives you a secondary story. So we're trying to get people to look past the surface, even from the moment that they make their reservation to come and join us.
That's excellent. So there's a lot of breadcrumbs that you've kind of put out there to start giving the clue to audiences that they need to take the initiative to look deeper and to kind of examine every single piece that you're putting out there. So there's a tremendous amount of work in all of those elements that you release.
Well, and that's our goal. I mean, we hope that people will look past the surface and dig a little bit deeper. I mean, a perfect example, if you're in downtown Tampa right now on a high-rise building, you will see 12-story, 15-story banner of Lucy. And what's really ironic about it is it has absolutely no mention of the Vault of Souls. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to get that image or key images out there so that people go, hey, what is that? What we're doing basically is attracting people who want to dig deeper. You know, if you put everything out there up front and make it all easily attainable, then I don't know whether we're necessarily attracting the audience that will enjoy this the most. You know, at last year, one of my favorite comments is I had several guests who went through the experience and they said, you know, for years when I was dating my husband or dating my wife, we would go to theme park haunts or we'd go to independent haunts and we loved them. We'd have a great time. Well, now we're married and have kids and, you know, we want something that's a little bit more adult. You know, we don't need the blood, guts and gore. We've been inundated by that. And this was a great way for us as a couple who are a little bit more mature in our lives now to still celebrate the fun of Halloween without, you know, having to deal with some of the other issues that come with the more, I'll refer to them as conga line haunted houses, because you constantly feel as though you're being rushed through or waved through with an attendant with a flashlight. That just simply doesn't happen here. It's a much more relaxed evening. You experience the same story for the whole night, and it's an elegant evening of fear that gives you an opportunity to celebrate Halloween as a grown-up.
Excellent. We're going to take a little break here and hear a word from our sponsors. And when we come back, I'm going to ask Scott a little bit about how he prepares and directs his actors to really train the audience to participate more in their environment.
It was intense.
When the apocalypse comes.
When I was running, I completely dodged an entire crowd of nine.
Will you survive?
You gotta act quickly.
Z-Tag brings the undead to life.
If you take your time, it's gonna be too late.
In a real-world challenge.
Next thing you know, you turn around, there's zombies.
Of speed, agility, and survival.
This is an awesome birthday.
It's zombies against humans.
Buildings, it was mazes. They're jumping out of everywhere.
Wear your Z-Tag badge with its flashing LEDs and get into action.
It really felt like zombies were coming at you at the end when you see the red tags everywhere.
Hunt or be hunted, take your pick.
It was a game you had to find.
Red light for zombies and green light for humans.
When you're like walking in and all of a sudden zombies come by.
Your survival instincts will be put to the ultimate test.
I would play Z-Tag again.
Do you have what it takes? Hashtag play Z-Tag.
Welcome back. We are speaking with Scott Swenson, the creative director of The Vault of Souls in Tampa. And before the break, we delved into what The Vault of Souls was bringing to Tampa this year, a little bit of the backstory on it, and Scott's primary goal of creating an immersive and interactive, elegant evening, a full evening experience where he trains and allows the audience to master and take control of the environment. So what do you do to train the actors to be able to bring that out in the audience?
Well, it's interesting because the actors are basically living as these characters for the entire evening. I really rely on them to bring a great deal of research and of their own personality, they have to really own these various and sundry characters. So as we rehearse, I explain to them that they have to, it's much more important for them to just be these characters in these environments than it is to try to be showy or try to be presentational. It's far more important for them to just exist in these spaces. And as the guests come in, they become new characters within these spaces. And what's very interesting is I actually train the actors who are not in the basement, who are in the Arrival and the Gin Joint and the Reader's Clearing. I train them differently than I do the actors in the basement. The actors in the basement have a lot more free rein in developing their characters. The ones upstairs, they're the exposition. They're the characters that help set the tone, that help get people in the mood. We've added a brand new character this year called the historian. As guests arrive, he will have a briefcase of documents and such to help get people started on the story, sort of like giving them a little amuse-bouche before the main dinner so that it whets their appetite. They can learn just tidbits and pieces about some of the characters they may encounter down there so that when they actually find them, the guests will have a sense of success. You know, it's like, oh, great, I found somebody that's who that guy was talking about upstairs. And then the characters downstairs, I tell them, do not worry about backstory. Do not worry about exposition. Don't worry about telling the backstory. Live the now. Because if you're living the now, for the guests who want to dig deeper, they will learn to understand what the backstory is. Yes, it is ambitious, and it's not for everyone. The actors at the Vault of Souls will continue to either make or break the event. Of course, I feel that's true about any haunted attraction. As much as I love the technical stuff, as much as I love the special effects, if you have a team of great actors, a dark room, and a candle, you can do an incredible haunt. I think it's essential to give the actors that same sense of ownership with the characters that we're trying to instill in the guests so that they understand not only practically what they need to do, but theoretically what they're trying to elicit in others.
Can you unpack that a little bit for us listening here? Tell us an instance in which you saw this happen. You saw one of your actors in the basement area doing a great example of existing as the character in the space, and kind of color this for us so that we feel what that is like.
Sure. There's a character who was incredibly successful last year, and he is back this year and actually being played by the same actor, which is just a blessing in disguise for me because it makes it much easier to train him. We can go even deeper than we did last year. But the character is referred to as Dr. Truth. And he is a character that is surrounded by nothing but mirrors. So when you walk into his room, you are looking at reflections of yourself and those around you. And keep in mind, as a guest, you're all wearing a neutral white face mask. So you're seeing reflections of only people's eyes. And from time to time, he will take a guest by the shoulders, lead them over to a full-length mirror, and place them in front of the mirror looking at a reflection of themselves. Now, when we originally started last year, he would try to make up some sort of story that may or may not be applicable to the individual guest. He would try to make up something that was period in 1920s. And I said, you know what? Be more vague. Don't give them so much exposition. Don't give them so much backstory. Just say something that will allow them to adapt it into their lives. I mean, one of the examples that he uses, and I don't think this is too much of a spoiler, but one of the examples he uses, because he's got a lot of them, one of the examples he uses is he will whisper in someone's ear as they're looking in their own eyes and their own reflection. He'll whisper in their ear, you know, he was always disappointed in you. And then he'll walk away. That's immediate. That's in the moment, and it becomes immediately part of, because, you know, I think everybody has someone who they feel, whether they really were or not, they feel was disappointed in them. And by dropping that bomb, it just starts the whole guest's minds going, how did they know that about me? Is that person here? Is that spirit really here? You know, it kind of breaks that realm of fantasy and reality. And it's doing it by, as I say, being in the moment, not having to worry too much about the backstory. We've already, you know, the whole environment pretty much tells that story. And just by planting the seed of immediacy in the guest's mind, the guests are now living in the moment as well.
Excellent. I can really feel that, you know, how you're down there in the experience, you're exploring, you walk up to a mirror, you're led by an actor and he puts these thoughts into your head, and then you keep exploring and you're kind of, all of this is building together.
And you know, it's very rare that guests scream at the Vault of Souls, or they jump. There's very little startle that happens at the Vault of Souls. And, you know, don't misunderstand me. I've done many, 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 many haunts that are based strictly on high startle. But in this particular one, it was difficult for me because I wanted to pull back as much as I could to make it so that it is so incredibly atmospheric that it lets the guests' minds really wander, because the space itself kind of lends itself to that.
Are there any other elements that you have planned for this year, similar to the keys and the lock boxes you were talking about earlier, that kind of allow guests to create and take away and master their own environment?
Well, I have kind of a funny story from last year. We had a character the character's name is Sparky, and it's the spirit of a handyman who's been trying to replace or repair an elevator since the 1920s. The actor was going to the guests trying to get them to help him find the up button so that he can install it and everyone can leave. Well, we had guests who are actually bringing bits and pieces of other props to him, asking, you know, in mime usually, is this the up button? Is this what you need? So after the first weekend of him saying, I received everything from knobs off of drawers to, you know, unusual little buttons that we didn't even know were down there. So what we decided to do in that particular case is we actually put vintage elevator buttons in various locations around the basement. And if guests would indeed bring him an up elevator button, he had copies of a poem written about him that's part of the poetry book that guests get as they leave. He had copies of that poem with, again, a secondary message in the bolded letters that he would give guests in exchange for the elevator button. So it was one of those things where not only did the guests in the moment have the opportunity to change the direction of the story, but based on their reactions, we became reactive and made it really, truly a part of the experience, a planned part of the experience. And then it went even one step further. We have a person there whose sole job is to maintain the elevator throughout the course of the night. So usually he doesn't do a whole lot. Actually, last year he didn't do much of anything other than just keep an eye on everything, make sure it was all working right. But he actually had a couple of extra elevator buttons. And he decided, well, what if I put a few of these down here? He had elevator buttons that the character had never seen before. So Sparky was like, where am I getting these? And let me use the phrase, let go and let God. You know, you kind of have to let go and recognize the story. The structure of the story is there. And we're going to have to trust the fact that everybody is on board to help take what they're given and move that story forward and make it so that the story just gets richer and richer, as opposed to getting scared and trying to have that ultimate control at every moment.
What, was there ever a moment for you or any of your team where you were a little uneasy about letting certain elements go in order to create this more fluid experience?
I think there was when I was writing it, but when it actually got into performance and we got the extra cast members who are actually the guests, when we got them in there, we all just kind of realized this thing has a rhythm of its own. And the cast was very well trained and very well rehearsed. And when we got the guests in there, we just all of a sudden went, wow, this is right. I don't want that to sound arrogant, because I really, like I said, my fear was before it happened. It's like, is this going to work? Are we going to be able to keep people entertained? Once we got them in there, we got a lot more comfortable saying, well, okay, so they're moving props. Is that really a bad thing? Let's just make sure we get them back to the right location eventually. But no, the first night we had actors going, I can't believe people are stealing all of our props. And I said, what do you mean? Well, this was in the children's room. The metal horse is gone. And like the next break, one of the characters came from the main vault came up and said, hey, do you know where this metal horse goes? So we kind of realized this is a playground that the guests feel comfortable enough in to move things around and have a little bit more control over their environment. We just went with it.
Hearing all of this, I'm very curious as to your production schedule. How long or at what point did you start the story? And then when do you bring the actors in and how long do you train with them? Because a lot of these elements seem to take a lot of planning and a kind of a lot of, like you said, working with them to develop a real sense of what each of the areas are. So can you walk us through the production schedule a little bit?
For this year, we made decisions on what was changing and what was, as I said, we're taking the story deeper, not wider. So we're not all of a sudden introducing some alien or a pirate or anything silly like that. But what we did was we just took the characters and the mythology that we already had and decided to delve deeper. That pretty much happened in November, December of last year, so immediately following the event closing. Then we started in on the finding the right people to build, because we have a brand new scenic team this year. We have a brand new lighting and audio team this year, and they all started about February, March, and then we did casting in June. We started our rehearsals the beginning of September, and rehearsing the separate elements individually, and then now we're starting to bring them together so that the characters know where they fit in the grand scheme of things, what part of the story they're telling. Then we'll do several dress rehearsals. Then we have a media preview night, and then we're off and running with the guests. And the thing is, it will change from weekend to weekend based on what we continue to learn from our guests. So the process really doesn't complete itself until the end of the season. We usually try to rehearse somewhere around 4 or 5 hours at a time. I like to get into it and let them, have a little time to not just go in and go, okay, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to jump out here and I'm going to say this line. And I'm going to move on, because that only works in a conga line style haunted house. If it's just jump out, say boo and reset, which believe me is exhausting. And I have incredible respect for the haunt actors who are able to do that night after night after night. But this is more mentally exhausting. You have to spend some time. What do I do when there are no guests? Or what do I do when there's only one guest and they just hang out and they want to watch me do something? And my response is real simple. Do something. What would your character do in this moment? So if that means, if you're one of the children, for example, if you pick up a baby doll and start rocking it and humming to it and then offer it to the guest, that's the kind of things that we try to instill in our performers, and they come up with, once they're given permission to do something that is that simple, that has a story, that has a mini story all in and of itself, but it also tells a great deal about the character. It's a child who still plays with dolls, who's still willing to share because they're looking for a playmate. And that's really the story of Lucy from her first year, because she had no one to play with. In the kind of rehearsal that we do, it's not really based on what do I say. It's far more based on how do I live in this environment. And by having rehearsals that go a few hours, sometimes the characters just sit there and they look around. They go, okay, well, I can pick up that and I could go over there. And I always say, well, just then go do it. How do you train somebody to live in a space? It's tough, but if you get the right people and you give them the right permission and the right direction, usually you can get it out of them. It's pretty cool.
I really love the idea of asking actors to live in the environment versus repeat lines or, that type of thing. Live and react to the actions happening around you versus just being a trigger, just triggering your lines when people get close.
Most of them do have, 5 to 10 bits or lines that they can use, but that's only if you've run out of ideas or you're feeling uninspired at that particular moment, because it's much more important to me to have them react to what the guests bring. And in fact, this year, we're even going so far as to have the character who issues their mask. That character is going to have a grease pencil. He may make a marking on your mask. And depending on what that marking is, it may mean that certain characters will react to you differently because they recognize you as an ancestor. So we'll see how that plays out.
Yeah. Well, Scott, is there anything you'd like to add here at the end?
I just hope that, you know, if people find what we've been talking about here today the least bit interesting, or something, you know, want to experience something a bit more unique than a lot of what's out there in Haunt, please go to elegantfear.com and make a reservation. Come and join us in Tampa, or at the very least, follow us on the Facebook page and see some photos from the spirits that live in the vault. You know, we're all over social media. Check us out and hopefully join us for an evening of elegant fear.
Haunting the Globe is hosted by me, Philip Hernandez. The show is produced by the Haunted Attraction Network. Today's episode was edited and mixed by Mike Migas. Chris Thomas wrote and performed our theme song, additional music and vocals from Music Radio Creative. Today's sponsor was Gantam Live and ZTAG. Learn more at www.ztag.com or by finding them on social at PlayZTAG. Folks, if you enjoyed today's episode, please consider subscribing and leaving us a review in iTunes or your favorite podcaster app. Those reviews help us tremendously. If you leave a review, hit us up on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook, and we can thank you personally. Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay scary.